interpretation and guidance, but we only have, I think, like 25 minutes. So it's going to be kind of a bullet point run through. At the end, Ira will provide some suggestions and solutions, and we're going to circulate a really great detailed summary to the whole membership later today that was written by Ira Persman and his amazing associate, Liz Montano. So that will go out. I think it's going to come from
Alina Santana?
Yeah, so look out for that in your emails today. After this, both Miriam and Ira have to leave. I will stick around if there's questions after. Plus, you can email us. We'll send our emails with that summary today. So we're going to go over first SB 17, the immigration bill. I'm going to talk about what it does not do, and then Miriam is going to expand on what it does do. So this is going to be implemented July 1st, 2023. To be clear, it hasn't started yet, but it's around the corner. And let's talk about first driver's licenses. So what it does not do at this time is impact Florida driver's licenses for the undocumented as it relates to the DMV acceptable table. So those of you who might be new, there's a DMV acceptable table that's been, it's kind of a living document. It's been worked on and negotiated by the liaisons of ILA Central Florida and ILA South Florida for years through Tallahassee at the DMV. And it basically is a chart. It's released by ILA South Florida to the membership every time there's an update. Has the list of types of statuses of what you have to show to get a driver's license. If you read this bill carefully, that is still intact, so there's no need to panic there, but there are a couple of other things that have majorly changed related to out-of-state driver's licenses and community IDs that Miriam's going to go over.
Thank you. So in terms of community IDs, this bill does prohibit counties and municipalities from providing funding to organizations that issue community IDs. This has nothing to do with driver's licenses. In terms of driver's licenses, out-of-state driver's licenses are impacted. So if you have an out-of-state driver's license and you are stopped for a valid reason, right, you may be issued a citation and your license is kept in a list that the bill requires law enforcement to keep in terms of out-of-state driver's licenses. But what you need to prove for an out-of-state driver's license is that you have lawful presence, right? So if you have lawful presence, we don't know what the definition might be, then if you don't have lawful presence, that's when it could be taken away. But that's the, I think that's the main gist of the driver's license issue.
I think we should mention though, and I didn't know this before this panel, that there are 18 states that provide licenses for undocumented. So those 18 states are going to be listed on the website for DMV. So I think that's how law enforcement will kind of narrow that down. And in some of those states, they have special markings on the licenses if they're indicated that they're just given exclusively to undocumented. So I think that also will be part of it. So one of the things we talked about in preparing for this is, you know, certain steps have to happen. The person has to be, you know, pulled over. There has to be probable cause to be pulled over. It has to be one of those 18 states. And you kind of go from there. And this is a good new question. It's 18 states plus Washington, D.C. is on that list.
Right. So it restricts the funding, for community
IDs.
Okay?
Yes.
Next,
okay.
To hospitals.
Yes, so we're going to talk about hospitals. So for hospitals, hospitals accepting Medicaid will be asking for immigration status. So there will be a questionnaire, and this is where clients have to be really careful because it's going to ask U.S. citizen, person lawfully present in the U.S., person not lawfully present for your clients to answer. So advise your clients, they don't have to answer. No one has to answer. You can put the clients to answer. One of the things that you think about, though, vulnerable people, you're not well, you're having a heart attack, you're at the emergency room, are you really going to pay that close attention? So I think, you know, if you represent hospitals, you represent individuals, you want to make make sure that they're aware of this, because you don't want people accidentally putting their U.S. citizen, because it's just easy, and you know, maybe a front desk clerk does that at the hospital, we may end up with false claims to U.S. citizenship out of this. But what this does not do, like that's what I'm supposed to focus on, you don't have to provide immigration status, and the person is not going to be declined treatment no matter how they answer. On top of that, their immigration status is not going to be disclosed. There are reports that are going to be given by the hospitals that Marion can go over.
Right, so you don't have to disclose, as Christine said, but the hospitals are required to provide quarterly reports to the Agency for Healthcare Administration. And those reports contain the number of hospital admissions or emergency department visits within the previous quarter, right? Which were made by patients who indicated that they were either citizens, had lawful status, or other, present, or other. They declined to answer. So those statistics will be provided quarterly. And then yearly, the agency will provide the governor with a, will submit an annual report to the governor by March 1st of each year. And that report, in addition to statistical reporting on their immigration status, also includes the cost of uncompensated care for aliens who are not lawfully present in the U.S. and the impact of uncompensated care on the cost or ability of hospitals to provide services to the public, hospital funding needs, and other related information. So those reports will begin quarterly and annually to the governor every year.
Okay, moving on from hospitals, the next big section is E-Verify. So this is going to only be for employers with 25 plus employees, new employees as of July 1st, and any public agencies.
That's right. So there is a definition for casual labor. I'll go into penalties. I guess I'll do penalties first. So if you do have, so the penalties changed a little bit with the bill. For first-time violators, you have a one-year probation and required submission of quarterly reports to the department to demonstrate compliance. And for repeat violators within a 24-month of the previous violation, you're going to have a suspension or revocation of all licenses issued by the licensing agency, depending on the number of unauthorized aliens employed. The suspension for up to 30 days, 1 to 10 unauthorized aliens, 60 days, it is 11 to 50 unauthorized aliens, and complete revocation of license if more than 50 unauthorized aliens. So this is rather new in terms of violations. In terms of criminal penalties, so this is also new. It's a third-degree felony to knowingly demonstrate fraudulent documents for work for the alien. So now it is criminalized. That's another thing that the bill does. And keep in mind, private casual labor under Florida Section 443.036, you need to look at the definition. That's exempt from as an employee. You're not an employee, you're a casual labor, and also look at independent contractors that may not be employees.
Yeah, and I think the casual labor, I don't know if you mentioned, is it has to be part of a private household, not home.
Right? That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So, okay, moving on, the next one is, I think this one is difficult to realize just because it's people in our own industry, but specifically to DACA, their law licenses are in jeopardy for the state of Florida. When will that start?
2028, November 1st, 2028.
Yeah, so it's perspective, it's not going to be for anyone who's licensed before that, but the section of law that allowed DACA to have law licenses, if they have a work authorization in the state of Florida, there's some other requirements, it's going to be repealed as of November
smuggling. Okay, so human smuggling. I think there's been a lot of misinformation on this. I'll just say first, it does not cover living with, sheltering, or renting space to undocumented. So that is not in there. It also does not cover the transportation of undocumented within the state of Florida. It also doesn't cover overstate, so anyone who's overstayed, anyone who's been inspected, anyone who's been paroled, anyone who's been put in removal proceedings. So what does it, who does it cover, Karen?
So it does cover people who enter without inspection. Were not paroled, or did not present themselves in front of an immigration office at the border. So people that have not been detected by immigration. If they are crossing state lines, those are the individuals that could be subject to, the person transporting them can be subject to criminal liability. For the first offense, it's a third-degree felony. Separate offense for each individual, the person transports into Florida. So it could be a car with three people, there's separate charges for each. It's second degree felony for a person who commits five or more separate offenses, and it's a second degree felony for persons with prior conviction under this section. But I think it's important to also remember for the newer practitioners who enters without inspection and who's been inspected and paroled. Now, minors, there are criminal penalties certainly for persons who transport minors, but most minors that are entering are usually released from a detention center or they're usually from shelters. They're released from shelters. That would be a violation. It's entry without inspection.
And this is the last point. And there's other things in this bill, but we're going to move on to the last one. The last point is there is a $12 million appropriation that was given. It's non-recurring. It's for fiscal year 23-24 to the transportation of undocumented out of the state of Florida. So that is there. We're going to move on to the property bill, SB-264, and Ira is going to tackle that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you are.
Children. The first issue is, are they an independent contractor or not? In other words, are they coming into the home like, but not living in the home, right? I think independent contractors are considered independent contractors under federal law and under statute, so they would be protected. And secondly, if they're actually living in the home, as Miriam said, it's defined by what's considered casual labor under a Florida statute, and Florida statute under casual labor seems to suggest a certain number of hours for every 2 month period if the person is living there. So people should take a look at it. I doubt that even the current governor would actually be going into people's houses and fining them for having people taking care of their kids. And I think the intent was clearly to make an exception for casual labor in the home because the statute directly says that. Doesn't say anything else about any other kind of casual labor. The second thing about licenses, I just want to make it clear, and I know you both did, so I'm just kind of reinforcing it, is that it only applies really to licenses that many of our clients may have gotten in other states who don't qualify for a regular driver's license. In other words, these states have alternate driver's licenses for undocumented people. That's who they're going after. The interesting thing is how they're going to do that. I mean, what is it that they're going to do? They're gonna pull someone over who has a license plate from out of state and ask them what their driver's license is, or are they just gonna stop people who they regard as Hispanic and say, show me your driver's license? So I think there's gonna be a legal issue with respect to the driver's license issue. You should know that employer sanctions apply whether you have three or more people, because they apply under federal law, right? You still have to do the I-9s, you still have to fill out I-9s if there's three or more people. But this targets E-Verify for the state. And quite frankly, that's probably going to be upheld, because it's been upheld by the United States Supreme Court in a case called Whitting. So I think you need to start informing your clients who have 25 or more employees that they will need to do E-Verify. Okay. Just quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, SB 264. This bill is very interesting. I have to say, for many years of my career, I sued Marco Rubio first when he became a mayor in Hialeah, then when he went to the city commission, then when he went to the state, because he kept bringing up laws that bar contractual relationships with certain countries. That's what this bill, in many respects, does. It says that you can have a contract if you're from one of the five countries. Generally, those are kind of the terrorist countries or quasi-terrorist countries. For our purposes, really, as a practical matter, really means Cuba, Venezuela, and China is included, even though China is not designated as a terrorist country. And it says, in effect, that you cannot buy agricultural land in Florida if you are one of these five designated countries, or if you are a foreign principal. And a foreign principal is defined as someone who is domiciled in one of those five countries and is not a U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident. So what it means is that you can't buy agricultural land either near a military installation, within 10 miles of a military installation, or 10 miles of a critical infrastructure area. Now, the problem is, if you think about critical infrastructure, it's very, very broad, right? It includes airports, seaports, water treatment facilities, refineries, spaceports, because we have spaceports here in Florida. So it means that you can't buy agricultural property within 10 miles of any of those. And if you think about it, if you think about Miami, for example, and you know how narrow Florida is, it's going to be pretty difficult for somebody who's either a principal of the country or the countries themselves to buy property. The one exception, and this is very detailed, but the one exception is an individual can buy a home with 2 acres of property, not more, as long as it's not within 5 miles of a military establishment. So if you have clients who are, for example, Chinese clients, or Cuban clients, or Venezuelan clients, and they want to buy property, they can buy an individual home or tract of land, but only as long as it's outside of 5 miles from a military facility. The second part of this, and I think this is the part that's actually going to be a subject of suits, the kind of suits that I used to bring many years ago against Senator Rubio, is the purchase of real property and the contracting of certain property. And so the question is, can the state prevent individuals who are foreign principals or foreign countries or their entities. Remember, it's not just the foreign country, it's their entities, which may be some business and so forth, from purchasing real property in the state. And that's not agricultural property, that's other kinds of property. And that is going to be an interesting issue because a lot of that is governed by federal law as to what you contract, whether or not you can contract to buy real property or not. And my guess is that somebody is ultimately going to sue on those because they believe that that's a matter of federal law and the federal government makes the determination, not the, the state. Okay, I don't know if you guys have anything you want to, did I make any mistakes or what?
You know, I just think maybe we want to mention that this could impact EB-5 projects if there's real estate.
The EB-5?
Real property in the state of Florida.
Right. So this may have an effect on EB-5, I think principally where the foreign principal is defined here, remember, not a citizen, not a resident, domiciled in China, wherever they are, or Venezuela, if they are actually entering into purchasing real property that has to do with a EB-5 project, in other words, they have direct investment in it, they're prohibited, I think, from doing that. It may not, and it's clear, by the way, that it says if it's a partnership. So as you know, many EB-5s are partnerships. So you get 3 or 4 or 20 people together. They all buy, they set up a company and they buy real property. That's going to be banned under this.
Michael.
Would it ban loans?
Huh?
Would it ban loans from foreign investors? Because most EB-5 projects.
No, that's what I was about to say. Thanks, Andrew. So I think most of the people in the EB-5 community think that this is not a big issue because most of those partnerships are then loan agreements, right? In other words, they put the money together, they loan the money to a builder to build whatever they're going to build. That would not necessarily, although we don't know because they're going to make regs on it, but we don't know as to whether or not that would be considered an investment in real property that they're trying to prevent under the statute. My guess is that it's a stretch for them to say when a group of people get together to give a loan to some third party, and that third party decides to build something, that would be covered under here, but I don't know. Jeff?
Yeah, quick question. Is there a penalty? And is it a penalty, you know, for instance, I do real estate. If I'm an attorney and I go ahead and have a client sign a contract and we convey land, I prepare the deed, have I done something wrong if it's to somebody who's precluded from that? And what if he goes ahead and buys it? Is there anything in the statute that says what happens?
Well, you need to read this. By the way, anybody who does real estate definitely needs to read SB 264 because there are requirements that you submit affidavits in every real estate transaction now, in every agricultural transaction as well. So in other words, if you're buying agricultural land, even though you're not one of the 5 entities or 5 principals, you still have to submit affidavits saying to that effect that you're not covered under these laws. The penalty, there are penalties for failing to do it, whether the lawyer would be liable or not for malpractice for failing to do it. I imagine they would because there are penalties in here. Some of the penalties are pretty stiff. A failure to register to the Department of Agriculture on real property is $1,000 per day. So, you fail to do it for a year, you're looking at a great malpractice.
Okay,
now I want to talk about my favorite bill.
I just want to repeat, just say the question, just to people on the Zoom, the question was,
if you practice real estate, will you be held accountable for any of this? I do think, I mean, it wasn't really clear, but it said there was second degree misdemeanor for anyone who sells property in violation of this. So definitely want to read this. Definitely.
I agree. Okay, the last one, which is my favorite subject that I've become obsessed with over the last 4 months, because nobody seems to know about this in Florida, is HB 1285. Many states, you know, every state in the union has a National Guard. And that National Guard is under the direction of the United States military. It's not under the state, it's under the US military, so forth. There are some states that also have their own guard, you know, the California Guard, the Montana Guard, whatever it is. And those are volunteer organizations that are designed if there's an emergency in the state, you know, major forest fires and they need more people, major earthquake and they need help and so forth, to be able to call up these reserves to do it. The governor of this state 2 years ago during the hurricane and the pathetic response the state had to the hurricane said, Hurricane Irma, I guess it was? Irma. They said, you know, we need to have our own Florida Guard. We used to have a Florida Guard, I don't know, 50 years ago. And the governor said, I'd like to get $2 million for the Florida Guard. Everybody shook their head and thought that was a great idea, you know, get a bunch of volunteers together and have them do this. Well, it turns out this year, in this appropriation, HB 1285 does the following. It gives the governor $103 million. It allows him to directly appoint 1,500 people, fully armed, militarily armed, okay, and the governor gets to select individually who these people are, and the governor refuses to provide the names,
you know, who's going to be there,
or the backgrounds of any of these people.
My ex-husband, probably.
So within the next year, if this actually comes to pass, we will have a new militia in this state of 1,500 fully armed people. The Tampa Times said they've already contracted with an Israeli spyware firm to begin this, whatever this process is. I only tell you that, and my friend said I shouldn't say it, but if you want to read something that's similar to this, you should look at the history of Germany in 1936. That's all I'll say about it.
I think that this is going to be signed any day now, right?
Huh?
You think that this law is going to be signed any day now? By the governor.
Yeah, do I think it's going to pass?
It's already passed, didn't it?
Yeah, well, what's the question?
So the governor, you're expecting, is going to sign the bill?
It's the governor's idea. So, yeah, I think the governor will sign this. It becomes effective July 1st. And it's something I think all of you forget about being immigration lawyers, but as citizens should watch. And I'll tell you why, even as immigration lawyers, this bill gives the governor the authority to designate these people with police powers. So that means if they declare an immigration emergency, he can give them police powers to arrest people. That's what police powers mean, the power to arrest and the power to incarcerate. So it's a serious thing that I think everybody needs to look at and make a lot of noise about. I'm here to answer any questions if you have any, right? I mean, you guys can answer. I'm done.
Thank you. I think just one thing, I just want to clarify, because I don't know if we did, on the exception for purchasing that 2-acre piece of real estate, that's only for people who've either been, from what I understand, granted asylum, or they're on a non-immigrant visa, but it cannot be a B-1 and B-2. Am I right on that? Yeah. So just so everyone knows, the one exception has exceptions within the exception.
What about dual citizens? If you're you're Canadian and you're Venezuelan, are you still barred from buying property?
If you're a dual national? Interesting question. I don't think it's
answered in the statute. It's not answered. It only talks about if you are a U.S. citizen or
have a question from the Zoom from Natalie. She asked, how is SB 1718 defining 25 employees? Is 25 employees in Florida or 25 employees total? Can you repeat the question?
Yes. So the question is, is it 25 employees in the state of Florida? Are you subject to SB 1718, or what if they're in another state? I would, you know, E-Verify is required in the state of Florida. So if the employee, it doesn't talk to that and you don't have the regulations. I'm just speculating, but if you have an employee under your corporation in the state of Florida, I would assume that is you're required to E-Verify that employee, whether, I guess, they work anywhere else. That would be and it's not proven, so.
That's the thing, because it's very much in development right now. The state's not used to dealing with immigration issues or interpreting them, so we have to be kind of careful and err on the side of caution in how you approach it.
Definitely.
Anything from Zoom? Can you say that you're going to circulate?
I just wanted to say one other thing about the hospitals.
Yeah.
You know, it's very important that for those of you who represent clients who are hospitals, to talk with them about the process. I think because, as Christine and Miriam said, there are grave consequences if somebody signs an intake sheet and says they're a U.S. citizen because it makes a false claim to U.S. citizenship for which there's no waiver, they're barred. Many of you probably have had this problem where people have signed up for driver's licenses and they just sign the paper not thinking about it. And as a result of that, they're permanently barred from getting any benefit 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, whatever it is. And so there's a very substantial consequence of doing this the wrong way. And I think it's incumbent upon the hospitals to train people so they're not just saying, you know, I don't want to bother with this. Let me just check off that it's a citizen, because if I check off it's not a citizen, then I have to do other paperwork. So they check off the box, here, just sign this. You're standing there, you need emergency attention. You're just going to sign whatever they give you. And that's going to have a huge consequence for people. So that's the first thing. The second thing, I think Mary and Christine mentioned it, but there's no obligation for anyone, including U.S. citizens, to give your status when you go into the hospital. You can just say no. Like you can say, I don't want to give you my social security number. You know, no, I just don't want to give it to you. And I think we need to make sure that that word gets out so it's not just stigmatizing people who are undocumented going to hospitals, but telling everyone, you don't have to give that information. It's not really legitimate information. It's information designed ultimately, as I think Miriam was getting at, ultimately to punish people who are undocumented by trying to withdraw, you know, financial support ultimately from hospitals that are giving money to undocumented people. So we don't have to participate in that. And I don't think we should. So the next time I go to the hospital, when I have my last heart attack and that's it, I get up there and say, no, I'm not anything. I'm not a citizen.
Yeah, I think I'm going to decline to answer too. Natara, did you have a question?
Yes. I just wanted to know, in terms of the panic that's going on, and we're not even at July 1st, right? So my office is getting tons of calls. I'm getting calls from other lawyers that don't practice immigration law that want to know what to tell their friends, their family, the people that are calling them. And I do know that there are, you know, it seems that even though there's something on July 1st, we have police that are activated already, more so than we've seen, let's say, in the last couple months, and they're stopping people. And I only know this because they collected 60 people, I think, in South, or 6 a.m. coming into Miami Beach, and they only let one person go because one person had a work permit, and it happened to be one of our clients. But otherwise, they took everybody, and I think they did the same thing in Homestead. The question is how are these, you know, I don't see these, this is July 1st, so what's going on, if you know, maybe Mr. Kurzban, maybe you know, that's activating this situation now, and is there anything that we should tell our clients?
I think the question is, Atara is looking for what's happening in the community before July 1st, and solutions and suggestions, and are we seeing enforced?
I think ultimately a bunch of these issues are going to be litigated, right? I mean, this statute's going to be litigated.
Sure.
And it's probably going to be litigated, and the only way to successfully litigate it, given, I think, the current state of the law, is on not on its face, but how it's being applied in practice. So the most important thing I think everybody can do is document the instances where your clients were stopped, and, you know, have them just write up an affidavit and hold on to it, because you're gonna at some point need it when litigation starts after July 1st. That's the first thing. The second thing is they're going to do a lot of things that are just blatantly unconstitutional and illegal. They're going to just stop people who are Hispanic, and they're going to say, let me see your state, out-of-state driver's license. You know, they're going to do stupid things, because that's what typically happens when you're, you know, kind of giving people the opportunity to go out and go after, people who are undocumented. So I think it's important that we document everything that occurs now and after July 1st, because that's all going to be used in litigation against the government. That, you know, I don't know if you remember, but Joe Arpaio in Arizona, when they had SB 1060, you know, he went wild and did the same kind of thing, but they had a huge amount of documentation to say, you know, he was just pulling people over who were driving while Hispanic. I mean, and they were eventually able to get injunctions against them and so forth. And I think that's what, you know, I think we're in for a rough time, and I think we've got to be prepared for it.
And
maybe
you can speak into the microphone
for
your question, and then after that, Carla's cutting us off.
No, I'm not.
This is, I have received a lot of calls from people that are very worried that they arrived as a Latinx and they didn't file any asylum case or they don't have any application, pending application or something. In other words, they don't have any other identification or any document that supports them or can protect them under this particular situation. What should we respond to this type of people that they are super worried about?
So that's a tough one. So the question is, what advice would you give clients that overstay their visa and now in their I-94 period of authorized stay and they can't adjust in any way? I would say go to a really good immigration attorney and figure out what to do, because they're driving without a license. They'll be issued a citation. They will be going to court. There's really not a good answer. They're going to have to figure out a way to navigate the immigration laws.
Yeah. I think they were already at risk, but now you're probably going to see increased enforcement, so the chance of over is probably higher, so they need to strategize and get in. They need to go to your office and strategize.
Yes, I wanted to interject in the conversation that we're having, because as Miriam knows, Miriam and I have been doing outreach to our communities, and we have been discussing how do people in the streets present themselves and what are they supposed to do. What we've been informing them, our clients or the possible clients that we have, is know your rights. And the most important thing that we're disseminating out there is the news are making this a big mess, a bigger mess than what it is. So it is our job as immigration attorneys to try to keep the calm, although sometimes with issues like this, it's very hard to tell our clients to keep the calm. But until anything is done or somebody is really affected in the rights, I think that the only thing that we can do is try to disseminate the law as it is and the possible effects that it could have, document the incidents, and then move on forward. I don't want to cut you off. I know that there's a lot of questions from our membership. I want to thank you first and foremost for coming here, exposing the nuances of the law and how we should be advising our clients. But for those of you that are sitting here and people are watching out in Zoom, Ira and his associate, Ms. Montana, had put together a document that we're going to be circulating. I think that the email is going to come from Elena Santana, who's our incoming secretary. We're going to do the changeover of the term as we move along. I don't know if you have any further comments with regards to what we've been talking and discussing about SB 1718 today.
I just want to say I think we have to understand that things aren't that much different, really, in many respects, in terms of our clients who have not had status. I mean, they were always subject to being arrested before. A state of Florida official cannot just go and arrest somebody without probable cause. That's not in this bill. There's nothing in here that violates anyone's right to transport somebody within the state. The provision that says transporting from out of the state is only limited to EWI. It's not limited to somebody who comes in from Texas, is paroled, or is released, and a relative here goes and picks them up. That's not covered under this legislation. And honestly, I think that provision is going to get thrown out because it's contrary to federal law.
Thank you so much. I think they did a wonderful job. Moving right along. Thank you. Moving right along with our program, every year in our AILA South Florida chapter, we come to a closure with a big bam, and that it is with the conclusion of the AIC writing contest. For the past years, I don't know how many years, Fernando, if you can let me know, how many years have you been in charge of the AIC writing contest? So Fernando Rojas has been leading the AIC writing contest. This is a contest that I personally look forward to every single year. It's the contest where fifth graders write a poem regarding immigration and anything that has to do with coming to America and finding a safe harbor here. And so this year, Fernando Rojas has some very important introductions to make to our honored guest, fifth graders from different schools that they gather this year. We're hoping, AILA South Florida every year hopes that one of these poems reaches national. This is a national contest, and I am so very proud of Fernando and the AIC essay contest team for putting it together. And I thank you, the teachers, the parents, and obviously the students for allowing us to participate with you in this great event. Fernando, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. So we'll change the tone a little bit from all that negativity to some good news. Chair of the AIC Creative Writing Contest Committee. Next to me is Hazel Solis Rojas, who is a member of the committee, and she's going to help pass out the awards to our wonderful winners. Before before I start with the awards, I just want to just give you a little background on what the award is. The awards are called the Lee Chamberlain Memorial Awards. And the purpose of the awards is to reward those contest winners and also to inspire South Florida educators to bring U.S. immigration history and lessons into their classroom, and gives fifth graders the opportunity to explore America as a nation of immigrants. Fifth graders have two themes available to them to participate in the contest. One is called America as a Nation of Immigrants, and the other one is Why Am I Glad That America is a Nation of Immigrants? And they use these themes to discuss their personal immigration experiences, learn about and share family histories, or write about the broader questions of the challenges facing immigrants in a new land. This year, thanks to the efforts of our committee, we had over 150 entries from Miami Dade, Broward, and for the first time, Palm Beach County. So we actually had all the South Florida counties represented in our contest and our representative. Before we start, I wanted to thank the rest of the committee members, Raquel Trujillo, who's not here, the vice chair, Sharifa Tharp, who's the creator and the keeper of our EIC community creative contest website, where everybody signs up to participate. Hazel, thank you so much for everything you do. And Paul Kanchususki, who is in Puerto Rico, and who tried really hard to get us Puerto Rican entries into this year's contest. And the last second, we thought we had the school and we just couldn't get them at the last second, but hopefully next year we'll expand our contest to Puerto Rico, which we want. All right, so let's start with the awards. Third place winner is Tanishka Walla from Sunset Elementary. Before Tanishka comes up here, I wanted to just give a round of applause to her parents and acknowledge that her big sister, who is also here, Taranish, won second place 5 years ago. So Taranish is here, won second place 5 years ago, and her little sister now has won third place five years later. So thank you so much to the parents for participating in our contest, making it a family event and a tradition. So thank you so much. So thank you.
Tanishka is a member of her school choir and has done large audience performances. She loves outdoor sports and plays basketball. That is the best time of the day for her in school. She enjoys painting and art. She also is a safety patrol honor guard and loves raising the flag at school. She is involved with the Future Educators of America, which help teachers in their classroom. This year, she has been inducted into the National Elementary Honor Society. She has been accepted at G.W. Carver for middle school, where she will continue her language studies. She is caring and loves small dogs. Congratulations, Tanishka.
Persecution, we come with empty hands. We leave retaining shore. Facing stormy waves on a rickety boat, or crossing the Arizona desert with a windless kayak. We look to the sky above and make just one wish, that the Lord keep us safe, my many shall perish. Our spirits soar when we reach American soil. With nothing but our hands, we believe.